because you know why?
Why?
Because it feels right.
It feels right. Legendary.
Button.
Pressed.
Flick. Hello, Robert. I actually flicked the button. Talking about flicking stuff, you know?
Yeah. Flick it. That's right. That's what we were talking about. So, yeah, just Robert, tell me about this. Tell me about this Boston experience. A little Fenway Park, Green Monster. I heard there was a little rain there. All kinds of stuff going on. Tell me about it.
Yeah, it's fun playing pickleball in weird places, you know? Just places you should never be hitting a pickleball. So New York Stock Exchange is one of them. Uh-huh. Now Fenway Park's the other.
What about Park City?
Oh, it's
there's another.
God, you're telling me. And the snow outside on the pavement and the snow, like, that's another one. Yeah, never thought that would happen. Oh, so yeah, that's it's turning into like what I do in pickleball. I just play pickleball in weird places and you know, occasionally get paid money for it. Yeah. So hey, that's the career everybody, you know, aspires to have. So
there's worse things you could be doing, for sure.
Yeah, no, it was fun though. It's run by Pickle4.com. It's a new, they have a ballpark series, which they're doing Fenway. And this upcoming week, they're going to Oracle Park in San Francisco where the Giants play, and we'll do it there. And then they also are in control. I don't know if, I think they bought it or partnered. Bought the U.S. Open. So now they're, you know, running and operating the U.S. Open, which will be interesting. I don't know what else they're going to get into outside of the ballpark series and outside of the U.S. Open, but you know, this thing in Boston, no expense was spared. They did a good job putting it all together. Had some really unfortunate luck with the weather, and the whole thing was a wash on Sunday, sadly. But really cool experience, and just to be able to play pickleball in Fenway Park, and you know, be playing a point, then like zoom out and look up, and you're like, whoa, this is kind of bonkers. So pretty unique.
Yeah, some reasonable athletes have been on that field throughout the days. So pretty cool. And probably, if not the number one, top couple most historic ballparks out there. So I'm a little jealous. Yeah. I'm not going to lie. That's pretty dang cool. So
the oldest.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I mean, U.S. Open, I mean, that's a big deal. So it might have had a little dip in the past year or two in terms of pro level or pro experience, but always number one or number two when it comes to the fan experience and the amateur player experience. So that's not a small purchase from this group. So we'll have to see how that plays out next April as well.
Yeah, it'll be curious. You know, today we got a special guest, Adam.
Uh-oh.
You look a little, you're frozen on my screen. I don't know if it's your Wi-Fi or if it's my Wi-Fi. I'm in a hotel, so it certainly might be me.
You look, everything looks good from my perspective. Who is our guest, Robert?
It's Mr. Tim Parks. You know, the one and only Tim Parks from the Hard Eights, and he's gonna share stuff with us. So I'm gonna add him to the stream right now. Tim, welcome.
There. Tim!
Good to see you. Good to see you. I love the shirts, Tony. Good start. Here.
What else would I be wearing? What else would I be rocking? Happy to be here with my boss, Tim Parks, the Pickleball Illuminati, the man pulling the strings behind the scene. Let's go.
Long time coming. All the other podcasts I've ever been on were kind of foreplay, practice, reps, all for this.
Yes. Yeah. I like the first word the best, foreplay.
All leading to this.
Mm-hmm. So I happen to be in a little group chat with you fellas, and you guys are going to be seeing each other tonight in person. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Nunnery, you want to take it away?
Yeah, I mean, maybe not just tonight. We might have a lunch date. We might have a dinner date. Who knows? We'll see where the day takes us, but there's lots on the docket.
I mean, it's very reasonable that you guys could be smoking pot with ASAP Rocky tonight, as Tim lives above ASAP Rocky in New York, Tribeca. I learned all kinds of new things here at the draft this last Wednesday in New York. I tell you what.
Yeah. Well, my claim to fame is that ASAP Rocky, he blasts rap music like all day long. And yet I still average more noise complaints per month than he does somehow. And I'm not having parties like ASAP Rocky, so I think the people in the building don't have quite the same like tolerance for my music, apparently.
That's right.
Well, but yeah, no, Stone, it was good having you in New York. Mm-hmm. You had Adam had the classic country bumpkin comes to New York moment where he was wearing shorts and he wasn't allowed in the bar afterwards, and he had to be sent home, and everyone else went in. It's a rite of passage in New York City.
That's right. Hey, well, I'll tell you what, it's all part of my master plan now that I go to bed at 9 p.m. So I think it worked out perfectly that I didn't have pants on. I got to go home and fall asleep, which I was okay with.
Worked out.
Yeah, I mean, at this
stage, we're going to talk about it. Are we going to try to get me in trouble today, or are we going to keep it kind of toeing the party line?
I don't think we have to try. I think you just tend to do that. So we'll just I don't think we're toeing any party line. We're jumping over lines today. So let's get into it. How was the? You guys were both at the draft in New York. How was that?
Stoney, you want to?
Yeah, no, it was great. I got in. Another New York country bumpkin moment is I went 5.8 miles in 44 minutes. I was, apparently this is standard stuff for city dwellers. It rattled me a little bit as, I just had my phone out. I couldn't understand how we weren't getting, making more progress. But anyway, no, it was really cool. We did it in Central Park. I got there about halfway through the premier draft. And so we got in the weeds real quick. We were researching. We had about an hour and a half to prep in person before the challenger draft, and ended up playing a little pickle after the draft, and ended up heading to team owners Jason Stein's rooftop restaurant for some some food and some beverages. And it was just a lovely day, I'm not gonna lie.
There's a great clip on our social media that I think tells kind of the whole story. run by Chanel and Chris, and she does an amazing job. But she's kind of going through getting clips behind the scenes. And she has this one where she's like interviewing Adam. And Adam's like, it's really tough. This is going to be very hard. There's a lot of good players and smart GMs, and we got our work cut out for us. And then there's a clip of me, and I'm like, this is so easy. We have such an advantage over all these fools. No one else knows what they're doing. Like, this is light work for us. It kind of that is our relationship. That's why Stone and I work well together.
Yeah, and that's it's so true. And it wasn't just a fabricated clip that you can manipulate. That's literally how it all went down. And that is our relationship in a nutshell. So well done, Chanel. She deserves a shout out. She's a gosh darn champion on that social media.
Yes, she is. That's fun.
So this helps. I got a question. So you guys. I would imagine the prep for the draft on the Premier side is much more intensive than it is on the Challenger side, because Premier, you're locked in with those players for the whole season, whereas in Challenger, you can make a silly pick or make a stretch pick in the original draft and then, not get penalized too hard because you can drop and shuffle and all that stuff. So is that fair to say? Less prep goes into Challenger?
I actually think the opposite. Yeah, I think more prep for Challenger. Number one, like Premier, you know all the players and you kind of watch them just organically. Like if you're just watching the stream, you see all these players play. Challenger, a lot of these players aren't on the streams. So you really like need to dig into the results or go watch like grainy YouTube footage of like some random match in Portland, Oregon from 6 months ago. And you're also trying to project like a lot of these, like, a Tyson McGuffin or Jay DeVille, like, exactly what you're going to get. Whereas some of these other players, like they weren't full time. Now they're full time or, they've been playing with crappy partners. Now they're playing with good partners. Like there's a lot more kind of forecasting and projecting with the challenger players. So I think it's more work. In a lot of ways, though, it's a more interesting problem. Like I think everyone wants to play in Premier because it's the highest level of pickleball and it's the most fun. But there are some things that are actually more fun with the challenger. One is this kind of level of like, recruiting and scouting. But the other one is just, you kind of see it like in our group chat with the team. Like there's a certain level of enthusiasm. Like these challenger players, some of them, they weren't sure they were going to be picked, or like they haven't really played like too much MLP, or they're still young and up and comers. So there's kind of this level of enthusiasm and excitement that I think you probably don't get with some of the old crusty vets who have been through the game. So it's actually like in a lot of ways, it's more fun, more interesting.
No, I think that's a good point. Rob and I have talked about that, many times as more seasoned pro players is sometimes, not as if I made it to the top, but I got to a pretty good ranking throughout my career. And the climb is more fun. So proving yourself that you belong, getting some big wins over those players that you've seen on YouTube. And then as you get more established, still, very, very cool, very intense. But it is definitely two different dynamics throughout your pickleball career. And that hunger is real, and you can see it not just, you know, in the comments, but just you can see it with the body language and how these players are coming into the challenger level. So I think that it is a cool dynamic.
Tim, any thoughts on people that got left out of the challenger draft that didn't get picked up? Obviously there's a lot of comments and stuff about Callen not getting picked up, you know, maybe Steve Deacon, some guys like that.
Yeah. I mean, I heard your draft recap. I actually think a lot of people are missing the story here. So the goal is not like people are saying, well, Callen's clearly a top 48 male. And yes, maybe he is, but that's not really the point. Actually, a lot of these teams, they're kind of like reaction function. Like what they're optimizing for is not just picking the top 48. You're picking a player who has maybe, if you're picking a fourth round male, you're not picking someone who's top 48 today, say fourth round challenger, right? So he's essentially an eighth round male. You're picking someone who has the highest odds of becoming, let's say, a fringe premier player in December. And Callen had, like, we know exactly who Callen is, right? He has no chance of like, all this, he's been playing for 7 years or someone even like a Tyler Loon or whatever. Like you kind of know exactly what you're going to get and they're steady and they're consistent. But if you think, if you kind of go back and look at the history of MLP, every dominant team, every dynasty, they basically became that dynasty because a fourth round player or maybe a late third round player by the end of the season was like first round caliber, starting with December 2021. That was you, Rob, right? Your draft slot where you're picked and who you were at the end of that season was way different. Like you played like a first round player. So that was kind of the advantage. Then you go to BLQK in 2022. They took Paris with essentially their last pick. By the end of the year, she's probably the best or second, and along with Anna Bright, best or second best female in all of MLP. And then you go this year, you have, obviously you have, Collins' brother was the first pick, but Megan Dijon was the fourth, she's third round pick. And she was basically like a 1.5 round player by the end of the year. And then on the other side, you have Julian Arnold. I think he was third round. He was moved to a first round pick. So like the story of MLP is you kind of need to pick someone who has a good chance. If you're trying to win, a good chance of like moving up three or four rounds over the course of the season. And I don't think some of these guys like, you know, Callen Dawson or Steve Deacon have the same chance of doing that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good way to look at it. And I feel like it also kind of depends on, yeah, how much of your kind of draft selection changed based on where you are in the overall standings? Like, would you have done things differently if you were in the top four or top five?
Yeah. No, and that's exactly what I'm saying is like if you're someone like the Mad Drops, who you're basically in Premier no matter what, unless you pull a clean cause Frisco yeah. Pandas and lose every match, you're pretty much in Premier. So what you should do is they should pick like the stable players and just like, just try to grind out a few wins.
Yeah.
So someone like us or like Vegas or teams towards the bottom, you need to, unless you have someone who like an Ava, like maybe she's not like a huge upside player in terms of like, you know, age-related upside, all that. But to me, like she and Yana are, we kind of know what we're going to get, but they're like third, fourth round players who are getting in the fifth and sixth round equivalent. So like in that case, you have to take those players. Yeah. But by towards the end, like, yeah, you want players who you think could advance and like CJ Klinger or someone like that. Like the kid, he'll probably be 2 inches taller by the time we get to December, right? And he's just evolving. He's growing into his body. He's figuring it out. So somebody like that, like he could easily work himself into being a fourth round, that kind of lefty, you know, someone who like somebody like a Riley Newman or someone we want to play with in Premier. That's totally conceivable. So like, I think, yeah, we were a little more risk seeking because of where we were in the standings.
Yeah. Speaking of Ava, she was one of the challenger females that I thought could easily go in Premier. That's a good pickup.
Yeah. I mean, I had her in like the low 40s. I actually had Yana as well. So, I mean, in my eyes, I got two premier level women. And I mean, yeah, when you get someone who's, we said she got with the 50th pick in the draft and she's like low 40s on her board. Yeah. And the great thing is she's proven she can dominate on the challenger level, right? Like she's in all three events. So that's kind of a perfect first round pick where you know what you're going to get. And then you can do some of the more upset picks following her. And I mean, the same thing, Yana, I think she's a premier level talent. She was a casualty of being on a very poorly constructed team clean Frisco Pandas, where, I mean, when you take Zane with your first pick, like that's kind of the original sin. Like your team's going to suck no matter what. You have no way of constructing a team with that. I know, no disrespect to my boy Zane. But like Yana, I mean, there's not many challenger women who are making PPA championship Sundays. She's done it. And in the last challenger, she beat the Pablo Ava super team with Daniel De La Rosa. She's beaten Kelly and Lucy. She's beaten Leigh and Elise. She's beaten Jesse and Jackie. Like, these are really high level results. Yep. We're getting her in the second round of challenger. This past weekend, she made the semis in women's doubles. She gave Anna Lee the business for a while in singles. So that's a really high level talent. We're getting her in the second round of challenger. And then, I mean, CJ, we talked about briefly, but I love lefties. I'm definitely in this camp that lefties are kind of like the new frontier in pickleball, and it's kind of like lefty pitchers in baseball. Like, they will be eventually seen as having a lot more value.
Yeah.
And he has a great presence in mixed. He, you know, he's had good APP results with Millie Rain. I think he only lost to like Hunter in Paris in one tournament. He's had close losses to Fed and Pablo. This past weekend, he beat Hayden Patrickman, who's, I think, second round pick. So, yeah, I mean, he's solid hands, good finishing power. And the great thing with CJ is Ava prefers the left and mixed. So, obviously, lefty, he's perfect. And then Todd Fott, our essentially fourth round pick, the eighth round pick of the draft, he did not look super comfortable in season one with Callan. I think he slots far better as a left sider. So, again, CJ on the right there. I mean, Todd this weekend, he beat Julian and Thomas, right? I think that's first and third round premier guys.
With a non challenger player as
right,
a partner.
Right, right,
partner.
Right. Yeah.
Yes.
So, I mean, I think that the team is constructed really well and they're playing super well right now. So yeah, I think we're definitely top three challenger team, probably number one.
Yeah, no, I like that. And to touch on what Rob said earlier, or just a couple general draft kind of thing, strategy stuff that I've learned from fantasy baseball and stuff like that, is wins above replacement is a huge stat in baseball. So replacement level is massive. So I think it even makes more sense in challenger to take shots and then have those handful of solid guys that you can replace if it just doesn't work out. So that is a huge stat in baseball. It makes a lot of sense for this challenger draft. And also another thing in baseball fantasy draft is it's not, I like this player, I don't like this player. It's where they are drafted. I have no differences. I have no different thoughts between Jay DeVilliers from what I did in the first season and right now. I did not like the Jay pick at all in season one, and I like the Jay pick in season two. It's all about where he went as the ninth or 10th overall in season one, and now I believe it was pick 40 in season two. So a lot of this is not necessarily I like this player, I don't like this player. It's where is the value and where he is being selected, and that is the most important thing to know about the draft.
No, I completely agree. I think this is something that's totally misunderstood. How good or bad a player is actually irrelevant. The only thing that matters is the imbalance between the perceived value and the actual value. Like, that's it. And I mean, this is kind of one of the original insights of Moneyball, is that, well, when you're looking for that imbalance between perceived and actual value, you look for areas where people like GMs or scouts or teams are persistently irrational. And we learn people are really systematically irrational because they overestimate their own experience. They overestimate recent performance, and they overestimate what they see with their own eyes. Like, you bring up baseball. The difference between a 75 hitter and a 300 hitter in baseball, that's one hit every 2 weeks, right? That's not discernible to the naked eye. That's only discernible through statistics, only as a matter of record. And so I think when you're talking about this kind of like, where players are picked versus their actual value, like, again, it's purely a matter of overrated or underrated. And that kind of goes to that, you know, the first question I ever asked you when I met you, Stone. It's like, I wanted to see if you sort of thought along this kind of line with me, where everything is a matter of what, like, it's a zero-sum game. Where are we picking versus what the market thinks?
Yeah, that's right. No, I remember that conversation. I do also remember having a slight beer buzz when I was talking to you. But I believe what happened is why we ended up kind of working together is you had asked several people. I might have told this story before on here, but whatever. But you asked several people, is singles overrated or underrated? And I believe all 15, 20, 25 of them said underrated. And I was the first one to say overrated. And It's, I mean, sure, my thought process matters, but that in itself right there, 25-1 probably gives you a decent amount of information, just that right there.
Right, right, right. I mean, yeah, like there's two types of people in the world. There's those who view the world probabilistically and those who view it deterministically, right? Like, or you put it another way, like those who think this is just a game to be played and then those who think it's a problem to be solved. And I think I wanted to find someone who kind of thought along the same lines as me. And, you know, so my thinking was like, look, I know nothing about pickleball, but I know this is a zero sum game and I know something about zero sum games. And in order to, let's say there's 12 teams, right? If it's perfectly efficient, let's say you just draft according to Duper and Duper is a perfect representation and every team is exactly equal, then you have a 1 in 12 chance of winning, right? 8.3%. Now, as a GM, your job is to get that 8% to like 15%. Like realistically, that's all you can do as a GM. Now, how do you do that in an efficient system? Well, you have to be different and you have to be right. So the first thing to do is you go looking for areas where prevailing wisdom might be wrong. And there's kind of three areas that I identified. One was there's this idea that females were much more important than males because, number one, they see more balls than mixed. And it's always the sort of your strongest or weakest link. Like if the average female has a Duper of 5.5 and the average male is 6.5, well, the 5.5 is more determinant of winning and losing. And then so that was one. Another area was that singles are really important because – you know, there's a lot of ways to end up in a dream breaker. Basically 3 out of 8 combinations get you through dream breaker and a dream breaker determines who wins the match. And therefore singles, you know, it's who determines who wins 3 out of 8 matches. It's really important. And the third one was like energy, because you saw players like Rafa and others going crazy. And you're like, this is really important in the MLP format. And I thought these three things that were kind of conventional wisdom might be wrong, but I wasn't sure. And then I go and ask 20 people. I say, hey, do you think singles in the MLP format is underrated or overrated? And everyone said, oh no, underrated, it's super important. And Stone sits there and thinks for a minute and he's like, no, actually, I think it's probably overrated. So that was kind of the beginning of our relationship.
Well done, Adam. You passed. You passed the test.
All right. I didn't even know I was being tested. I love it.
Well, those now, are the best. Those now are the best look at tests. Me. Yeah.
Rolling the dice for life. Let's go, baby.
Well, I have a question for you two guys. Okay. So that was October 2022. Now we've played, I guess, 4 more MLPs since then. If you had to update your view on singles, do you think, Adam, we were like more right or less right? Like, has the evidence we've had since then, are you more sure or less sure that singles are underrated?
That's a good question. And I would say slightly more sure. Slightly more sure. It's just so shit showy. And, you know, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but I saw a lot of, I've talked to people and I saw quite a few, on paper players, getting beat down by people who don't even play, PPA events and singles quite a bit. So, numbers don't lie and I would need to look at those, but I would say I'm slightly more behind what I said previously. Is that, how about you?
Yeah. Nunnery, what do you think?
I was just thinking there has to be like, I feel like we're behind and just having really clear data on points won and singles, you know, based on what your Duper ranking is. You know what I mean? Just like seeing what the actual results are. Like that should be a very easily accessible stat in my opinion. And we don't have it. So it's just kind of going off of memory and I think singles is still probably overrated in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, my Dreambreaker views have been a bit misconstrued. Like on Graham and Travis on one of their podcasts, Tennis Sucks, very good podcast, by the way. They were like, oh, yeah, Tim Parks, he's an idiot. He doesn't think that Dreambreakers are important. Like the argument isn't whether a Dreambreaker is important or not. It determines who wins the match. Obviously, that's important. The discussion is about, number one, is whether the amount of volatility in the format makes it really possible to predict. And number two, like, is there any scenario where you take a slightly worse doubles player who's better at singles? Like, obviously, if two players are perfectly identical in doubles, fine, you take singles as a tiebreaker. But realistically, like, you know, Adam, now you've kind of been in a couple of drafts with me. That's never the case. Like, every draft slot, you're deciding between, like, 3 players usually. And, you know, it's usually, well, this one's slightly better at singles and this one's slightly better at doubles and, like, kind of, like, how are we weighing these things? And I actually don't think you need the stats that much. I mean, I do have the stats on what everyone's Dream Breaker record is. The sample size is so small, it's almost meaningless.
Yeah,
like,
correct.
I think like Callie has won 100% of her Dream Breaker points or something. But I think you can actually think about it just from first principles. Like, let's say 37.5%, right? 3 out of 8 matches go to a Dream Breaker. Now, let's say you're top end male. So that means on average in a Dream Breaker, you'll play 12 points. So that means per match, like, we're going to do 1 minute of math, people. Hopefully your eyes don't glaze over. Per match, if you have a 37.5% chance of going and playing 12 points, it means you're essentially playing 4.5 points, right? Now, if you're a great, great singles player, let's say you win 65% of your singles points, which is like kind of unrealistic. So you're winning 65% of 4.5. That's like whatever, 2.9 or something, right? Now, let's say you're like a terrible player and you're winning 35% of your singles points, right? So 35% of 4.5 is 1.6. Okay, so like the GOAT singles player, his average singles win is 2.9. The worst ever is 1.6. So per match, the worst player versus the best, both singles monster versus like someone who's totally useless, is 1.3 points per match. So basically, like that's really, you can find that now in doubles, you're guaranteed essentially 80 points. So basically, like if you do the math, like being 1% better at doubles, 1% better over 80 points, is the equivalent of being 18% better in singles. And so I actually don't need to see the stats. I think you can just think about it logically and be like, singles are just mathematically less relevant.
That's my guy. That's my guy breaking it down. I mean, I don't have anything to say about it. There it is.
Well, yeah. And I, by the way, I have another piece on this that I think this is something I haven't heard discussed. So all credit to me for this original insight. But, The modern singles game, and by modern, I mean like 2023, it's kind of evolved, and I'm curious if you agree. It's evolved. It really revolves around huge serve, huge return. Like in doubles, the serve and return are kind of like the foreplay, right? It's like the serve, return, drop, everyone get to the kitchen for the real action. In singles, the serve and return, like that is the main event most of the time. Like in many, you've reached a climax before you even got your shoes off. Like that is the main event. So what this means for Dream Breakers is like there's a much higher degree of variance in singles. There's way more missed serves and returns long in singles if you just watch a random tour event than you'll ever see in doubles.
Yeah.
And this is fine in a singles match where there's an average of 100 points usually in a full like best 2 out of 3 singles match. When we're playing in 4-point bursts, this higher ball style of play with big serves, big returns, it injects even more randomness into it. So I think the fact that Dream Breakers don't happen as often as people think, they're not 50% or 37%. And this 4-point burst style, like it makes it like there's just so much randomness that, you know, and we see examples like teams like the Fives last year,
yeah,
who are on paper, like they should have been absolutely dominant in Dream Breakers. I think they're like roughly 500. Now, part of that is because Ryan Harwood was committing crimes against humanity and putting out Anna Lee second in most of these against the guy. And I mean, that's kind of a separate topic. I mean, she actually said on a podcast, I think it was MLP, the Inside MLP. She said, oh yeah, like I really like doing this because it takes all the pressure off of me. Like if I pass the guy, that's great. It's this great viral moment. And if I don't, well, you know, I'm playing Riley Newman. He's 6'3" and I'm 5'6". So like when he goes 10-2 against me, well, he's supposed to, right? Like it's almost bullying. He's bullying a 16-year-old. But if I pass him, it's this huge, like, you know, moment and everything. But I think like they're, you know, and then we saw it again with the Milwaukee Mashers in their playoff match. Like some of these GMs are just doing criminal things with their Dream Breaker strategy. But this is all kind of going to the point that like these teams that are perfectly constructed on paper, they're actually not winning more than a handful, you know, a slightly 51% or something more than other teams. So it's kind of like, I think I'm with you, Stone, that I'm more sure now than I was that singles are, they should be almost neglected when you're drafting players.
Yeah, no, I think, hey, my famous line, numbers don't lie, but neither does sample size. You guys have to understand how important that sample size is. You get a big one, those stats mean a lot. You don't have a big one, it's a lot of noise in the numbers. So that's my take on that.
It's also why, like, when a lot of people are looking at like MLP numbers and data, it's like, there's just not enough to even look at it. You have to look at everything else, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and this is the thing with stats is like we're basically in like year 1880 with the baseball box score.
Yes.
Where we don't even know if we're measuring the right stuff. And we don't even know if we're playing the game right. I mean, this is something Adam and I, we've had long conversations about. We're probably playing the game completely wrong. And like realistically, the pro game has been around like say 5 years. And Major League Baseball is around for 100 years. Before we realized that like, well, walks are really, really important. And oh, like a triple is way more valuable than a single. So batting average isn't really a good measure because it doesn't distinguish between a triple and a single. And like, you know, the thing that really matters is on base percentage, not batting average. I mean, NBA, we're playing for 30 years or 40 years with a 3-point line. Before we did the math, and we're like, wow, 3 points is actually a lot more than two. Like not a little bit more, like 50% more points. Maybe instead of optimizing around all these 2-pointers, we should optimize around 3-pointers. NFL, same thing, like passing, you know, you realize like if I'm trying to get the most yards per play, passing is almost doubly as efficient as running. So now everyone is kind of pass first offense. So the odds that we're playing pickleball correctly 5 years in when all these other sports have been around forever, it's like, it's odds are zero. Like in 5 years, and I don't know what it'll, maybe it's tons of lobs. Maybe it's like zero dinking. Like I think that's probably more likely where it just becomes like every ball sped up. Like generally at pro sports, the most aggressive team, the most aggressive strategies is the right one. And I mean, I see these teams line up against the Johns Brothers and just getting these dinking patterns. Like you have no chance. Like you're an underdog anyway, but you're certainly an underdog if you kind of fall in this pattern that they exactly want you to do. So you should probably adopt some kind of like hyper aggressive strategy.
Yeah. And this is not, we're not talking about some under radar sport like ultimate frisbee or something. These are the big three sports that took decades to clean up their data and figure out the right way to do it. Exactly right. It's on base plus slugging percentage now instead of average. Now we, right. In NBA, we want dunks, we want layups, and we want 3-pointers. We don't want mid-range stuff. The numbers are just not there. So the fact that these huge sports, the biggest sports in the country, took this long, you just have to look back at how it went down with them and expect us to be in the same situation, which I think we are.
Yeah, and it can change as technology changes too. So, Tim, what do you think in terms of, because when Adam, let's say Adam came into the game before I did, well before I did, and we talk about how technology in the game has changed in terms of paddles and equipment. It's turning into like where you have tennis players coming in using full Western grips, which just means it's almost a Riley Newman grip, but hitting forehands with it. And that's changing the game to a more aggressive game. And what's your take on it as somebody that's kind of newer into the space and in respect to, faster points, more aggressive points, more spin? It's in a sense, especially in singles, it's turned into a big serve, big forehand, which is very much how tennis has evolved and turned into.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fair question. Like this is something that I think all these sports are struggling with. Like the NBA, like we're saying, You have GMs and teams and players, like say us, who our job is to find an edge and just ruthlessly exploit it over and over and over.
Yeah.
Now, this edge may not be the most aesthetically pleasing. And there's a lot of critiques in the NBA now where like teams just take 43 pointers and just try to get fouled and get to the foul line because that's the most efficient way to accumulate points. In baseball, your pitchers are supposed to throw 100 miles an hour and just play for strikeouts. You don't want to like pitch to contact or anything like that. Because when the ball is in the field of play, like bad things can happen. You want to just strike players out. That's the best thing a pitcher can do. So you have a million relievers who each pitch one inning and you all throw 100 miles an hour. And it's not the most aesthetically pleasing. Oh, by the way, you like shift your defense over. And so now like, and you're never supposed to steal and you're never supposed to bunt and you're never supposed to tag up. And these are like the exciting plays in baseball.
Yeah.
But they're mathematically not maximizing like expected value. And so you're kind of off, you're optimizing the game mathematically to try to win. People are responding to incentives. You know, you get fired if you don't win, or you get shitty contracts as a player. So it's like you're supposed to do what it takes to win, but kind of on the whole, the sport becomes less aesthetically pleasing or less fun for fans. And so I think when you're asked about like speed and all this stuff, like players are just, I think the technology is improving, and so their strategy and their gameplay like adopts like changes with it. I mean, Stone makes this joke all the time. He's like, if we're using the paddles from 10 years ago, he'd still be a premier level player. But the problem is that like now when you're rewarding like speed and, you know, athleticism and like that kind of stuff. It's not as stone. But I don't know. I mean, this is something I've kind of like deferred to people who know more. To me, when we were having this, you know, early in the year, the whole debate was about paddle testing and all this stuff. And I was kind of the opinion that, like, I don't really like dinking. I think dinking is pretty bad for TV, and people, like, viewers are watching it and, like, they don't really understand it. Like, new people are like, what are they doing? Like, why are they not hitting the ball hard? I think, so I was okay with, like, faster paddles and D-line paddles and all this stuff. I was like, let's just ramp the game up. But then, yeah, you do hit the point where it becomes just like squash or some of these other sports where it's so fast that it's almost like so full of randomness and it becomes pointless again. So there is some balance there. I don't know exactly where that line is between, like, you know, speed and, you know, and golf is struggling as well. Like, it's fun seeing guys hit 300 yards, but now, like, all of a sudden every single player hits his driver 350. You're like,
yeah,
well, maybe you should roll back the technology. You know, it's like that point where it was fun and interesting when a couple of guys are doing it. Now everyone does it. It's commonplace. Like, maybe we should roll it back. So I think this is a constant balance, but I am not as worried about the speed of the game as it seems other people are.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair assessment. And yeah, I mean, they made this sport, they made the kitchen, they made the underhand serve to make it different. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like you said, you know, 5 years ago, it is all about consistency and well-timed aggression with long dink battles. And now it's a little bit more. You can create offense from different spots. And the balance is the key. Because you don't want it to be a psycho free for all where no one dinks ever or ever puts shape on the ball. It's just hectic. But at the same time, you want to keep the game with the roots, but you want it to be aesthetically pleasing, like we talked about. So balance is the key, like it usually is. But I'm not sure exactly which way we should lean more to. It's not a decision for me to make, and it's probably never going to be absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
All right, Tim, I got a question here, getting a little bit more into the business side of this wonderful sport. So there's a lot of people talking about just overall valuations of teams, how they came up with that figure, and kind of some of the ability and ways that the leagues and the tours are going to be able to monetize this pro pickleball thing moving forward. Is there, you know, any insights or any information that you can give us that might make it a little more clear for the fans back home?
Yeah, I mean, this is a 5-hour topic with a few balls in itself. But so there are a few questions there. So one is just like kind of generically, if you believe the sport of pickleball is going to explode, and there'll be 50 million, 60, 80 million people playing the sport, and you're, you know, of a business mind and you're trying to find a way to monetize this, how do you do it? No, one way is like just try to directly monetize amateur participation. You sell paddles and balls. You build facilities. You run amateur tournaments. You do stuff like that. Another way is like, well, you try to monetize the pro game. Because if you actually go and look, and we've done this study, if you look in basically every populous country, the most played sport is either the first or second most watched sport. And you can even go to like Ethiopia, right? A really random one where like cross country is the most played sport and the most watched sport. You go to Iran and it's wrestling. You go to Bangladesh and it's cricket, right? Like virtually, and now there's a few like China where ping pong is the most played sport, but basketball is the most watched sport. But guess what's the second most watched? It's ping pong, right? And so like virtually every country, there's a pretty strong correlation between the sports that are watched and the sports that are played. Now pickleball is probably, at this point, maybe the third most played sport in the country, and it's maybe the 50th most watched. So the correlation has it. There's like this lag that, you know, we all hope who've invested in this that will catch up. So that's kind of like the generic version of it. Now, obviously, within pickleball, pro pickleball landscape, you guys have talked plenty about this. There's two directions to go. One is you try to just imitate and you make mini tennis, a mini PGA tour, a mini ATP tour. And that's kind of what we have with the APP and the PPA. And then there's MLP, which is trying to do something different. And that's creating team-based format with like proper like sports franchises. And I think clearly I'm an investor in MLP. I'm a partisan. And no one is unclear where I stand on which format is superior in the long run. But I think one of the brilliant insights of Steve Kuhn when he invented MLP was that sports franchises not only did they create more storylines and more drama and more intrigue, and there's drafts and there's trades and there's drops and there's all this kinds of stuff. And there's just more parity, right? The random PPA weekend, like, there's no uncertainty. We know the result before they even play it. There's absolutely no uncertainty. MLP, there's tons of uncertainty. Almost borderline for my thinking, there's too much uncertainty in MLP.
Yeah.
But there's a reason to watch. PPA Championship Sunday, there's zero reason to watch. Like, I kind of make betting lines with some, you know, Jason Stein or Richie or whoever every PPA Sunday just to have something to do while we're watching. And it's like every match, it's like 8-1. And we're like, do I really even want to take like Irina against Annalie at 8-1? No, like a fair odds are probably 10-1.
Yeah.
And so it's really terrible. Whereas in MLP, like no team, even like the Seattle Pioneers from last season versus like Frisco Pandas would never be more than like 3-1 or 4-1. And most are like pretty much even money, a coin flip match. So from like a drama and like product standpoint, I think MLP is brilliant. But you were asking about the business side. And I think this was the real genius of Steve Kuhn, was that sports franchises are, in my eyes, they're the equivalent of like oceanfront real estate. There are only so many of them and you can't make any more. And the price of a sports franchise is driven by scarcity. So let's say there's roughly 1,000 billionaires in the US. If you want to own, and maybe 4,000 in the world. If you want to own a pro sports franchise, the only way to do it is you need to outbid a bunch of other billionaires to get it. This invariably causes prices to escalate every single time one hits the market. It's a really, really smart way to bring money in if you're trying to build a bankroll and build a war chest to like grow out the pro game, is to create sports franchises. And I think we've kind of seen, I was thinking about this recently. If you look at like the sports franchises that are run, like the NFL versus the NBA and Major League Baseball, I think MLB and NBA are much more on the cutting edge of like efficiency and optimization. And part of this is because the people who are buying NBA teams, there's way more turnover, first of all. The people who are buying these NBA teams, they come from hedge fund and private equity and technology, venture capital type backgrounds, where they're used to like harvesting a lot of data. Whereas in the NFL, I think almost half the teams are inherited. These people have only like a glancing familiarity with like, you know, large data sets. And I think Steve has done a really, really good job of curating his ownership groups to have people who've come in with like experience and expertise that like can help grow the league. And I mean, you have someone like Adam, we were talking about Al Tyless, who I think is probably the smartest kind of sports business mind involved in Major League Pickleball. And he, you know, he owned DC United and he's running his DC pickleball team like a proper business. Like he, you know, if you look at like Rob, you just played at the Fenway event, right? Fenway Sports Group, they own Liverpool FC. And that is like the most optimally run organization where they're running it like a proper conglomerate, like an international conglomerate. They're running it like it's General Motors or Google or something like that.
Yep.
Like Al Tyless, like he, and there's others, Man City Group, where like you have this kind of like organization. So Al literally took like a person who's working for DC United and like promoted him and moved him, Adam, to go work for his DC pickleball team. Like he's, not only are you moving like players around throughout your organization, you're moving like the managerial talent. And so I think like people like that coming in, and there's others too. I think there's a lot of teams that are very well run. But it contrasts someone like that to a team like us, the Heart Eights, who are like, when Riley wants to go get a massage, I just like Venmo him for it, right? Like it's not like a professional, like, but these people, Al Tyless, like they're used to competing against like Arab oil money in their organization. You have to run super efficiently because there's always someone with a bigger bankroll. And so I think the genius of MLP is that we're like harnessing all of that talent and we're not just trying to make another slant. Tennis light tour. So I think that's kind of where I stand. I don't know. Did that answer the question? I can keep going, but.
No, I think that was very good. Tim, do you think while there are several teams run very well in MLP, do you think that there is a handful of teams run very poorly in MLP as well?
Yeah. I mean, for sure. The frustrating thing for me, Adam, and you saw this, is that the format right now is so high variance that like, so, you know, like, so Wednesday night after the draft, we're all sitting around, me and a bunch of GMs and Adam's there and a bunch of owners. and we'll debate something like the singles or like who's more important in mixed or who should have been the first pick or whatever. And I'm invariably completely correct. And the instant that anyone can't disprove my argument on the merits, they just go, oh, wait, where are you in the standings again?
Yeah.
And it's happened like a super lot. Frustrating because the standings are not the most accurate representation right now. It's like, what's this sour grapes? Talk about season one for a minute. So you have a situation where like the Heart Eights against BLQK, we had a better point differential. Yet they kind of lucked their way into one final. And now they're way higher in the standings. You have someone like the New York Hustlers who in Mesa, 1-2 in group play. Generally, you go 1-2, you shouldn't advance. They somehow advance. They get a lucky run. They make the finals. They're way ahead of us in the standings. To say nothing of the fact that we absolutely destroyed the Hustlers in San Clemente. Like every match was like 21-10. So like in my vision, we're better than these teams, yet they're way ahead in the standings. And as a GM, like you can't control the outcomes. Like Adam and I always talk, all you can do is control the process. And if you would tell me that in Daytona, all we need to make the finals is that basically our men's doubles, Riley and AJ, need to beat the Vegas men's doubles. They need to beat Deckel and Kyle Yates. If you'd have given me that, I'm like, as a GM, you've done your job. Like, I need Riley to beat Kyle Yates. Fine. We lose. Then we go to San Clemente. All we need to make the playoffs is, again, Riley and Lindsay Newman to beat Kyle Yates and who is it? Viv David?
Viv, yeah.
And again, Riley against Kyle Yates. And Kyle Yates, OG Heart Eight. He was on our team in Columbus last year. He made the finals. Love the guy. But that's a mismatch of epic proportions. In mixed doubles, Kyle against Riley, like that should be 80% or something. Like that's basically as big of a mismatch as you can kind of construe. So as a GM, again, you've done your job. Now, if we win that, we go, we play ATX, who's not a super strong team, right? Like now we can possibly make a final, right? Then we play the fives after that, a team we've already beaten. And then who knows, right? So there's a little bit of this like outcome-oriented thinking that we're still obsessing over too small of sample sizes. And I listened to Zane's live stream yesterday. Zane and Thomas Shields, the Dink, they did one during the draft. And Zane said several times, he's like, well, the guy strategy didn't work in Premier last year because his team sucked. And then the Heart Eights didn't make it out of group play one time. It's like, well, first of all, if Riley just beats Kyle Yates these two times, and this is not hating on Riley, he's my favorite guy and my number one bromance in MLP is Riley. But if he beats Kyle Yates those two times, we make two playoffs and, you know, then we're off and running. And by the way, to say nothing of the fact that I took AJ with my second pick. If I took Julian or, you know, maybe even Ignatovic or somebody like that, or Andre, who was on the board, well, like things could have been very different. My third pick, I took Mary Brascia. If I take Megan Dijon, who's on the board, it's very different. So there's kind of like the outcome-oriented thinking versus process-oriented thinking. Like the strategy of Guy was perfectly sound if you just pick the right players. So I think there is a lot of kind of not like super sophisticated thinking through some of these
questions. So basically what I got from that, Tim, there was a lot of good stuff, but basically I got, if you want to be a successful guy franchise, do not draft Zane never till first round.
Yeah, I think that's a fair summary. The second is you'd like to have Riley Newman for all three events. And AJ, we would like to have good AJ. I think we had it San Clemente. But he's a very, as you like to say, high ceiling, low floor player. And we definitely explored the bottom of the floor a few times with AJ. But he's doing much better now. So
based on where you are in the standings, do you think you talked about variance, and obviously this is a small data set right now. With the scoring format and how it's set up, I mean, based on your team, you should be ranked higher in the standings. And of course, a bunch of little things happened that led you not to be, but is that an example of how there's too much variance in kind of the team setup?
Yeah, it is. It is. And so one of my suggestions is we move group play to six. So we'd have to play an extra match, but group play would be four matches rather than three. I think that would smooth some of the variance. Yep. There's other things. I mean, you could always like tinker with the scoring, make games to 25 rather than 21, like stuff like that. So there are ways to do it. But again, like all sports, it's a balance between you want some drama, right? You don't want the favorite to win every time. This is the problem with PPA, is the favorite wins every single time. And I mean, they're talking about going to 3 out of 5. Like, that'll remove any last hope of drama, right? Then the favorites will never lose in that format.
Yeah.
So you don't want it to be the situation where you know the result going in and you have no reason to watch. But you also don't want it to be complete shit show variance randomness where, like, there's no advantage to being the better team because it's just, it's like, you know, you're playing a point to one, like game to one. You don't want that either. And so there is that, like, kind of like tension between it. And I think MLP is maybe a touch too random right now for my liking. And, like, you know, you've talked, if we move to a season long format where you play, you know, 40 games and home and away and all that, like, that'll sort of solve the problem. The tournament format is hard because it's like the NCAA tournament. Like, that's really not that good at identifying the best team. The best team usually runs into, you know, it loses. Whereas, like, a sport like the NBA is much better at identifying the best team because it's much lower variance expression. So you're kind of trying to balance, like, find the midpoint of this.
That damn word balance. It's just so important, but I'm just not very good at it. But I do think everything you said is right on point. And also, as a player, whether that's pro level or lower level, I think that there's something to be said for a level of variance that creates false hope. I see this in poker as well. It's like, you can be poor and think you're okay. You can be okay and think you're very good. I think it's the same thing with pickleball. If you're a 4-5 or a 5-0, you think you can be a pro. If you're a 3-0 or 3-5, you think you can, you know, you think you belong in that tier above. So yeah. I think all of those things are good in general for just attracting people to the sport. And, you know, you pair that with some of the stuff that you just said, you know, finding that balance is going to be really important. And you need both. You need the best players to win more frequently, but you need the variance. It is an important factor to have.
Tim, in a perfect world, what's an MLP season look like for you moving forward? Let's call it 3 years from now. Where would you like to see MLP be? What would the format be? How many teams would there be, Premier versus Challenger? What would the season look like, et cetera?
Well, I have to be respectful of that other three-letter tour that shall not be named. But if I had my perfect world, it would be, yeah, a full season long with home and away. So something like an NBA season where you maybe have half an NBA season, but you'd have you know, the LA Mad Drops play the SoCal Hard Eights, and you would have, you could even maybe, you know, expand, have like 2 out of 3 or something like that, and to reduce the variance a little bit. And yeah, and you have a full season long, like a team is, you know, 23 and 18, and, you know, the like that would be way lower variance. And I think better way to capture who the actual best teams are. So that's kind of my vision, is like, in a perfect world, every player is just playing MLP and we have all the best players and we have a season long format like every other pro sport. I think that is, if pickleball is going to explode as a professional sport, that's the direction it needs to go. I don't think the kind of tours where you're picking your partners and there's all that kind of stuff is the same sort of, is going to capture the public's imagination in the same way that a team kind of season long, and you just create different storylines. Like, the problem with the other tours is, like, even if you have a storyline like, oh, you know, Matt and Riley are catching up to the Johns brothers. Like, okay, well, like, this weekend team A wins, this weekend team B wins. Like, who cares? There's no real consequences. Yeah. They play again next weekend and it's the exact same stakes over and over and over and over. Yeah. And you're like, well, at the end of the year, they're just kind of splitting up the prize money, but there's no real, like, consequences. There's no, like, majors or championships. And so I think, yeah, you need to kind of, like, create this, like, crescendo towards something, which is what MLP does a great job of. Like, yeah. We always kind of are reaching the climax. For the other tours, it's just flat drama. Like, 1 week to the next, there's absolutely no difference.
100%. Do you see it being like two, like, American League, National League, where you have 12 teams in each, and then each team maybe has 6 players instead of 4 or 5 yeah. instead of 4? What's that
look yeah, like? Yeah, I think you can do that. I think you can have, like, almost like minor league teams, like kind of like a farm system. I mean, I've even talked about, like, some kind of college affiliation. Like, there's all sorts of things you can do. But yeah, I think one thing that's really important. Oh, going back to your initial question about, this is relevant, but to your initial question about, like, how a lot of the crusty old vets like Callan Dawson and Steve Deacon weren't picked. I actually think it's very good for the sport that MLP exists to give these kind of up and comers a chance. If you think about it, like, if some random college kid, if he knows that, like, he has no chance of going pro in pickleball unless he gets these like top 10 partners, but he can never get a top 10 partner because he doesn't have the results to show for it. Like, you can't break into this kind of cartel. Whereas MLP, you just need one owner to just take a shot on you and you're in the cartel and now you come and get results. So if you think about it, it's like that guy who's kind of on the border of not going pro or not going full time, all this stuff. Like, he doesn't want to deal with the politics of finding good partners and all that nonsense. All he has to do is get noticed by one MLP GM. And so I think for the pickleball ecosystem, MLP is great and the draft is great and this kind of potential free agency system is great because you're kind of expanding the pool. You're giving these players who otherwise wouldn't really have a shot, a fair shot. And growing the pool is kind of the name of the game. So
from well said. And I think it gets clickier by the day in terms of groupings and tiers of players who don't want to dip down. And it's just harder and harder to get into it. So instead of playing with a lower level player and working your way through the APP or whatever minor league pickleball, you can have someone take a shot on you and be on a big stage with a team that is at your level. So a lot of good points to that. And just to touch on what we said about the, you know, occasional staleness of the constant tournaments. I've said it 50 times, Rob, Triple Crown. I mean, come on, just have a mixed Triple Crown, have a men's and women's Triple Crown, and just give us a little variety, give us a little spice, see something different. That might be the last time I mention it.
Or no Triple Crown and we just go full MLP and then we don't have to worry about the variants and tours.
Yeah. Rob, you said it. I was going to go there too.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have to worry about that if that's not if the
you're welcome you know. For the setup, fellas. There you go.
Perfect. I got a question for you though, Tim. On in yeah, terms of like you said, players breaking, I think it's a great point where, you know, you just need to be noticed by one GM. I think at the moment though, players still have way too much influence on draft selections at the moment. We even saw it with premier players being in the tent or being on staff with challenger teams. I think, you know, you had Rafa Hewitt helping Richie on the challenger picks, and that's why Marshall Brown got picked because he trains with Rafa. I know James Ignatowicz and Anna Bright were helping the Hustlers. Like, you have these premier MLP players essentially affecting the draft and who gets picked.
Paris.
Which to me is a gigantic conflict, and it's a real issue. It's one thing to have you know your first selection of the draft help you with the rest of your team, but to have players that are already in premier helping teams and challengers seems very odd to me.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of that, and I mean I've joked too with Brooks and Steve that the draft should go like turbo, like 5 seconds in between picks. And therefore, you're rewarding the GMs who have done the work.
100%.
Rather than getting on the phone and call. Like, that's an extreme example. But I think, I think that would be more fun. I mean, the one problem with pickleball, though, is the ecosystem is so tiny. Like, I kind of ran into this problem with Adam when I first, you know, hired him. Or we were like, you know, co-GM, assistant GM, coach, whatever the title you want to give. Brooks, and I love Brooks, and he works really hard to be objective and fair. But he's like, oh, this is a potential conflict of interest. Like, Adam Stone has a podcast and MLP has a podcast and blah, 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 all this nonsense. And I'm like, look, I'm trying to pay someone to help make this more professional. Adam Stone is hands down the most qualified person. He's an ex-pro, right? He's had high-level results. He is commentating, so he watches it. He has a podcast. If Adam Stone can't work with a team, then nobody can, right? Like, and the problem is there's so few qualified people to actually like help assist GMs. Like, you know, I came in knowing nothing. I was like, I need a pickleball guy to assist me. I can kind of think like grand strategy terms, but like actually breaking down, like, you know, projecting certain players, I need a true pickleball guy.
Yeah.
And there's just so few of them. And I think I got the number one guy, Adam, but like, there's not many, you know, Morgan Evans was snapped up by Arizona. And like, there's only maybe like five people on kind of that caliber. Yeah. So then you have these other GMs like Caitlin Kerr, you know, she was kind of like, she was, you know, the Las Vegas GM. She's sitting there and she's like, I have nobody to help me. She's like, I'm just going to pay like a premier level player, Andre Deescu, to help me draft because I just want somebody to talk to. And I think eventually, hopefully the ecosystem grows to where you don't need to just talk to current existing players. There will be more Adam Stones and more, you know, kind of retired people or people who are more full-time who aren't players. But right now there's just such a shortage of people who are kind of in the know that like you just invariably resort to some current players.
Yeah.
No. I like being special, and I'm only going to be special for a short time, guys. So it's nice to be special in this moment of time. I think that is well said also. And how about this? This is on topic and off topic. What do you think about GMs, ownership groups, drafting a player, a competent player, not just on the court, but thinking about the game, and then not listening to their advice for their subsequent second, third, and fourth picks? Now, more established sports, it makes a lot more sense for the GMs and their team to be making, making the choices. There's lots more information there. But how do you feel about not listening to a player that you draft and going a different route?
Tricky question. I mean, I overrode Riley on a pick, as you know, the third round. He wanted Megan. I took Mary Brasha, and Riley was right. I came to regret it. But there are times where, like, yes, Riley knows way more about playing pickleball than I do. But you were talking about the kind of like political element or like the clickiness. Like, there are certain, Jill Braverman, I think, is clearly premier level player, but she didn't get picked for political reasons. And I think at certain times, it's the GM's job to be like, look, I don't care if you are friends with Jill Braverman. She's a much better left side female than the one we just drafted. Your job, you're getting paid to go and play. And I think there's a little bit too much of this like overemphasis of like chemistry and friendship. And it's like, end of the day, your job is to go out there and hit the pickleball. And I when some of these players are getting uppity with me, I always joke with them. I'm like, you know, they're kind of falling in love with their celebrity a little bit. I'm like, you're just assets in a spreadsheet. You're just pieces of the puzzle I'm moving around. And of course, they don't like to hear that. And I don't mean it like literally, but I do mean it in the sense that like your job is that you're getting paid to go out and play, not to just select your friends. And I kind of like when I see situations where the GM overrides, even if it's wrong, where the GM overrides a player because they're doing what they think is right. And I think you saw that with like Gabe Tardio, you know, and J.W. Johnson. Like, J.W. clearly wanted to play with Tardio, and yet they took Colin Johns. And the GM was like, well, look, Tardio is a nice player, but Colin Johns wins gold every single PPA Sunday. And like, he's getting results. And so it kind of seems like that's the guy I should pick. Now, maybe there's a totally fair argument for Tardio, and I think there are. But I kind of like when I see the GMs overriding the players because it means it's being treated like a business. I remember thinking back to the first MLP event I went to was in Newport. And I was talking to, I won't name them, an ownership group from another time. There's only 12 teams. And they were like, oh, I could never drop a player. Like, how could I drop a player? Like, I'd feel so bad. Like, they're my friends. Like, they stay with me, all this kinds of stuff. And I remember when they said that, I was like, I will always have an advantage. If this is how everyone is, I'll have an advantage. And I think I was probably one of the most active GMs last year in dropping and trading players. And look, it was sad when I had to call. So we did this double trade. We traded Johnson Cola and Susanna Barr for Kyle Yates and Millie Rain. And then I had to drop Millie Rain, and we ended up picking up Sierra. And Millie is like the nicest young girl. Like, she's this like 17-year-old girl. She's all excited. She's going to play with her best friend, Georgia. And I have to call Millie and be like, hey, actually, sorry, we're dropping you. And like, that's hard. But Sierra is also this girl who's sitting out there working really hard, and she deserves a fair chance too. So why do you have sympathy only for Millie but not for Sierra? It works both ways. And I mean, it kind of reminds me, I remember one of my heroes is this guy, Sam Hinkie, who you might know. He's the GM of the former GM of the Philadelphia 76ers. And he was kind of the one who invented tanking in the process and all this kinds of stuff. Like, I think he's brilliant. I had the chance to have dinner with him one time. And I asked him, I was like, well, why did teams do things that are clearly suboptimal, like not optimal for winning? And like, why would the Lakers give 38-year-old Kobe Bryant like a $40 million deal? Like, that's like your whole salary cap. Like, you basically have no chance of making the playoffs. Why would you ever do something so irrational? And he's like, well, number one, they're not optimizing for pure winning. They don't care about that. They have to optimize for like jersey sales and other stuff. And that's totally fine. But like, it's okay if you come in and you're like completely rational. And another thing he said is like, these guys, these billionaires, like, they usually weren't athletes growing up. Like, especially today, there's some tech nerds, some 5'8 guy who just invented an app and became a billionaire. For him to say, I'm in a club with Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson and all these people, like, I'm finally, for the first time in my life, one of the cool kids. Michael Jordan looks at me and is like, you're a peer of mine. You're my friend. You're one of the guys. Now, if this guy comes in and starts doing all crazy disruptive stuff, Jordan will be like, you're not an athlete. You don't know, you know, and you're no longer one of the cool kids.
Yeah.
And so sometimes these owners are optimizing not to win, but optimizing for like reasons beyond winning. And so that was when I was kind of like, okay, as long as we're like purely rational and we're trying to win, we will have an advantage in the system.
Edge. I want an edge, Tim. I need it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I would like to see a move to where, you know, players don't have any say. I think letting the GMs, I mean, that's the GMs and the ownership's job, essentially, right? If our job is to go hit a pickleball, the GM and the ownership, the team, their job's to select the best team and the best product to put on court, whether it's, like you said, you know, to optimize winning or if it's to optimize marketing. I mean, we saw Sam Querrey got picked number one in Challenger last season, and I think it was for that reason, right? So,
I guess my point is, like, I don't begrudge the owners who do lean on current players right now just because there aren't enough people out there. Like, there, how many people do you know who watch every single Challenger match? Like, maybe 10 people on earth, right? Watch every single Challenger match. And so you're kind of like trying to just lean on people who are there. And I think hopefully as the sport grows, we'll have more people who are outside the game who are kind of like full-time scouts or GMs, that kind of stuff.
I was just going to say a lot of it's information too. You need to ask your first pick if you don't know the player pool very well after that. So having more of that information, I think it sets up to what Rob said, is once the GMs have all that and know that, then I do like them making those decisions. But we are in probably a new, unique situation where the GMs don't know the whole player pool, and that'll certainly change with time.
But I think that's my point, is that's why you bought a team. That's why, you know, you own a professional sports team. So that's kind of your responsibility now to figure out how to draft these teams. I don't know. That's my take on it in terms of.
No, I mean, I agree. And to me, that's the fun of it. Like, if you're going to outsource the draft, like, that's the whole reason I did it. Like this is a fun hobby. Like, I spend a disproportionate amount of time on pickleball stuff.
Yeah.
Way more. Like, as a percent of my, you know, like, portfolio or whatever, like, I really shouldn't be spending this much time. But, like, hobby, like, think about it. You have a hobby. Like, the perfect hobby in the world is one that makes you money, it makes you healthier, and makes you, like, smarter and more creative. And, like, pickleball and, like, this MLP thing, it does all three for me. So it's, like, it's a great hobby. I don't get why you just outsource the fun part of it.
Yeah.
Now, maybe, like, outsourcing the nonsense, booking the Airbnbs and that stuff, yeah, fine. But, like, the drafting, like, that's like what you live for as a GM, I would think.
Well, hey, that's great that it is, especially number two, making you healthier. I know you got out on the court quite a bit after the draft. What was your record in games after the draft, Tim?
All right. Well, I would rather talk about our game against Richie.
Oh, yeah, Richie, yes.
We could talk about that one first, and I can talk about my MLP day.
Fair enough.
So,
go ahead.
Please. Go ahead.
No. All I was going to say is I was just very, very excited that you made. I don't care about your bet with Richie. Your bet with Rafa Hewitt, who lost $5,000, that made me very happy. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing, you guys know Richie reasonably well enough now. The thing you need to know with Richie is that he will never agree to a bet unless the odds are totally stacked in his favor. Like, I've been making bets with the guys for, and he's the reason I'm in MLP and a good friend of mine and all that. But like, been betting with this guy for 10 years. To him, it is purely a means of making money. He's cold, ruthlessly calculating. And he doesn't have the same like love for the spirit of the gamble that I do. And credit to him. Like, the first, like, if you have that mentality, the most important skill is identifying your mark, identifying the person who will gamble just because they love gambling.
That's you, Tim.
Yeah, that's me. And I mean, he even said it, right? I think you had Coop on your podcast and you were talking about this bet, which, you know, me and Adam versus Jesse and Richie. And before he made the bet, he's in the thread with Coop and all the other pros being like, do you think this is a good bet? Blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So he clearly like goes and checks and, you know, does his homework. Whereas to me, with Richie, I'll accept the bet even when the odds are stacked against me because I just relish the challenge. Like that purpose, like that sense of mission and like, okay, I'm going to beat Richie. That's what makes me feel alive. And I was probably, before I played with you, Stone, I was probably, no joke, 0-18 against Richie Doubles. And yet I still took this $50,000 bet because I like wanted the challenge. And yeah, so I mean, Stone, it's like, it's losing my virginity. Like, you were there the first time I beat Richie. And in many ways, I'll remember this one more fondly.
That's so good.
I remember you recapped. You left out the best part of the story. When you guys did that live pod with AJ.
Oh.
So the best part of the story is, do you know what I'm going to say?
No,
so,
I don't.
So, okay. So we hire a ref because, you know, we're.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So we hire a ref and we're like, okay, $250 to ref this one game to 21. Like, it's like a great deal for the ref. And so she's like taking it super seriously, like has a score sheet out, like writing down. So she goes to me, she's like, who's playing left? Who's playing right? Like she's treating it like a proper match. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, the pros are on the left, me and Richie on the right. She looks at Adam Stone. She goes, wait, he's a pro? I'm like, well, he's not currently a pro, but like, you should know who Adam Stone is.
No, wait.
She looks at him like that little pudgy piece of shit is a pro.
That
was going
through your head. That thing?
I had to convince her for literally 10 minutes and she still wouldn't believe me. Like, there's a couple people on the sidelines, like Zane and Rafa are watching. I'm like, guys, you know, like, I played y'all before, you know, tell her. And she just cannot fathom that I played pro pickleball at some point in my life. I love it.
So good.
Until she saw that lateral kitchen quickness, baby. Let's go.
I was impressed. But yeah, I mean, then the draft weekend. And by the way, we shouldn't talk any more about this because Greg, one of our other owners, he hates when owners talk about themselves on these podcasts. But I think I went about 0-9 in rec games afterward. I went into the bathroom after, and it was me and three janitors in the City Pickle bathroom. And I was looking around wondering if I was the fourth best pickleball player in the bathroom. That's how bad I played. So it was ugly. But whatever. I got that first win over Richie. That's all that matters.
Yeah. But I will say this with those games after the draft. And it was a little mini owners tournament. But you can see when these titans of life are out there on the court, they want to win. These are just competitive people. And, you know, a lot of them are 3-0s and 3-5s, but man, you can really sense it that these people crush life. They're competitive and they want to win no matter what they're doing. And it was kind of fun to watch, to be honest.
Yeah, very true. Well, I always joke, like the only person, like everyone is super unhappy when they lose, except Steve Kuhn. He's the only one who's still like joyous and like just That's happy so to be playing. Everyone else, it's like day ruining when they lose, especially for like other owners.
I love Steve. Yeah.
So what's MLP looking like next year? All right. Like, well, I've heard some rumors of 16 premier, 12 premier. Is there anything you can share?
Oh yeah. What I can tell you is we don't know. Like, anyone who tells you they know definitively what next year is going to look like is lying. Like, it is completely in flux. Obviously we're still trying to coordinate with the PPA to come up with a schedule that makes sense for both leagues, right? Like, currently, like the way it works is PPA has 25 weekends and MLP has 6, and there's this huge content inequality and the players are complaining they're playing too much, but like MLP doesn't think we have them enough. You know? So there's like all this stuff that's being sorted out. So we're working in good faith with the PPA to try to come up with a schedule. But we don't know. I mean, I'm reading every single book on like English soccer and Premier League soccer because I think we're going to move to more of a kind of European soccer model, not just promotion and relegation, but like you can loan players, you can trade players for money, like all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I think all this stuff is great. And this is what I'm talking about with MLP, where you have these like this drama and this gossip and these storylines. Like the NBA is never more popular than during free agency period.
Yep.
People are – it's the most talked about thing on Twitter in the middle of the summer when the league's not even playing. So I think to the extent MLP can kind of generate storylines like that, that's where we're going to try to move towards. But, yeah, in terms of, like, number of teams and Premier and all that stuff, it's not sorted. And anyone who tells you they know is lying because I think I'm pretty close to the inside on these conversations. And every day it's, like, a wildly different track.
How many events a year do you think MLP needs to actually be a sustainable league where it can generate an ROI for owners?
Well, I think if we're going to stick with the tournament, like kind of festival event style, I think 10 or 12 is probably right. But again, I would rather see it more like a season long, like every other pro sport. Like to me, that's still has to be the end goal. So maybe we have this kind of intermediate year or two where it's this hybrid. But I think the goal is, we need to have more than 6. I think next year we're scheduled for 8, you know, theoretically, depending on how things shake out. But I think, it eventually needs to just get to a full season.
Got it. And do you think, yeah, I mean, I've always seen, I mean, maybe we don't want to go too far into the PPA MLP stuff, but you know, I'm going to ask it regardless.
Yeah.
Do you think, Adam, do you think, I don't know. I just see the conflict, right? It's like for MLP to grow in revenue, to grow in size, to become what MLP wants to be for its investors and owners. I mean, to do that, you need more events, right? And to create more events, you know, PPA has to relinquish some number of events. And it feels like it's a direct conflict with each other a little bit. So, you know, how's that relationship going to play out in terms of being partners?
I mean, it's no secret. I ruffled some feathers with my pickleball appearance when I talked about the PPA. And now, to be fair, it was like three suits. Like, and the vast majority of people all were like, what you said is completely true. And by the way, no one said what I said was untrue. It's just, oh, Tim, you shouldn't have said the quiet part out loud. But I think what I'll say here is the funny part, too, is after that pod, I went for a beer with Shields afterwards. And I was like, oh man, like, do you think I went a little too hard on the PPA? Like, is that going to cause any issues? And he's like, no, I don't even know what you're talking about. And then I rewatched it the day it came out. And I was like, oh, phew, like, Tim, you were super diplomatic. You didn't say anything controversial. And then, of course, like 2 days later, all these calls and emails and, oh my God, how dare you, all this thing. So anyway, I'm not going to go too deep into it. This is what I'll say is there's kind of a new regime within MLP. Julia, the new CEO, Bruce, the new COO. Steve is as involved or more involved than he's been in a while. And I think I'm really bullish these guys. I'm a huge fan. I think Julio and Steve together, they have what I think maybe we've been missing a little bit, which is boldness. Like, boldness has this kind of, this genius, this magic, this power to it. But most people are kind of afraid to act boldly. And I think there are certain things in life that only work when you commit. And I don't mean dabble. I don't mean half in, half out. Like, commitment all in all the time. And I think Julio has that, and Steve, we know, clearly has that. And I think, yeah, I mean, there's this old Latin saying that he gives twice who gives quickly. And that means, like, try to have audacity, have speed. And I think Julio has this kind of mindset. We're going to move quickly and we're going to kind of break things. And so I'm very bullish this regime. Now how that works out, you know, you're asking about the PPA relationship. I'm not sure, but I have complete faith and trust in Julio. So I'm just going to leave it there.
I like that guy. First time I got to spend real time with him this past Wednesday at the draft. And yeah, he's a bro. He's a guy's guy. He likes to, you know, poke you a little bit, have some fun, but he seems like a real go-getter and a guy who's well connected and has had some great success in his life. So I in that short time with him and bullish as well. He seemed like a legit guy.
I think one thing that's kind of, I don't know, I don't want to say missing, but kind of that's been slower than other aspects in terms of the growth of pickleball is obviously international. We see the APP tour doing an event in England, you know, kind of hosting the Swedish Open, doing some different things like that to have an international presence. PPA hasn't done quite as much in respect to the international stuff. I know there's been some murmurs about, you know, MLP doing some international stuff. So I just want to see kind of where that sits right now.
Yeah, so MLP actually hired someone, Scott Giles, who's outstanding, and he has experience with, so there's this thing called PDC, Professional Darts, whatever, in London, in the UK, and it's like absolutely massive, and even it came to, I think, Madison Square Garden. It's, if you haven't, like, go watch a YouTube video of this darts, it is electric, and so... I think the guy's name is Barry Hearn, who started it. And he's kind of this, like, crazy genius who, he was big in, like, billiards, big in, like, snooker, like, big in darts, like, all these kind of, like, really random sports. And he's blown them up in the UK. And Steve Kuhn has developed a great relationship with this guy with the help of Giles. So we actually hired Giles to come on and kind of lead the MLP International. So there hasn't been any, like, results yet. But again, I think it's an outstanding hire, and I'm very, very excited for what we do. I think there's a lot of big things we can do with international as well. That's kind of the sleep. I think college pickleball and I think international is the sleeping giant that we haven't even tapped into yet. Yep. But I know MLP is not, they're on it. They're aware of it and they're working on it. So yeah, I think if anybody can, I mean, look, like, darts is two fat guys throwing a little board. You watch these videos and the place, it's like a concert. Like, you can't believe the energy they've created. So if they're able to do that with darts, I think, yeah, they can do something huge with pickleball. And they understand the UK market and all that kind of stuff. So obviously Europe has padel, and that's a whole different conversation. But, you know, I think India, I think China, like YOLA, like, is obviously very well connected in China, and they're a huge supporter of MLP and a huge supporter of pickleball. So I think there's stuff to be done in China. So yeah, I think that is the sleeping giant, along with college, university pickleball.
Outside of those two things, over the next few years, what do you think? I guess what do you think is one thing about MLP that's going to surprise people?
You got him.
No. All right. I have a question. This is not, I'm somewhat evading your question here, but sure. I have a question for you guys. So I sort of got involved in pickleball, let's say late 21, early mid 2022. And everyone had this mindset at the time that just wait until the real athletes show up. Wait until the college tennis players, the real, because the money is now meaningful enough where, like, if you're going to be the number 100 tennis player, you're probably better off being the number 5 pickleball player.
Yeah.
And so it kind of is like, hey, look, I know that we have Anna Lee and her mixed partner are dominating every single event right now, but, like, that's not going to last. In fact, JW is kind of closing the gap in singles, and Matt and Riley are closing the gap in doubles and all this kind of stuff. And however, this year, like, I think he has more triple crowns than he did already, than he did all of last year. And so the thing that surprised me right now is that these two players, Anna Lee and her mixed partner, are basically expanding the gap. Like, why is that gap widening? And I asked this question to Travis over the weekend, and I asked Jason Stein. I'm curious your answer on that, because this is the most surprising thing to me, that it's kind of like these two players who are well-established, who we all thought were going to get unseated, are actually, like, expanding their lead on everyone else. So this has been surprising to me. So to your original question is, what, like, I always kept saying, like, oh, these, like, insane athletes are going to come in, but I'm a little bit less sure that they'll come in and dominate the way I thought. So I'm curious what you think there.
Yeah, I think singles, it happened, like, we've seen it happen pretty quick, like, with, you know, even Hunter and Yates Johnson. I mean, they played on the tour in terms of doubles. They played at SMU together. We see it in singles, but even I think doubles is just a different beast. You see Collins brother losing a lot more in singles than doubles typically. Right. And that's just because, you know, raw athletes coming over from tennis, and not just that, but also there's less of an adjustment for players coming in with the paddle technology. Now, I think players coming in 3 years ago, longer adjustment in singles, but now the paddles are almost similar to where you can have the same grip as a tennis racket, because the ball is grabbing the paddle face like it would almost strings. So it's less of an adjustment in terms of developing topspin and stuff like that. So I think it's happening quick in singles, but doubles is, you know, even though it's moving to a faster game, you still have, like, Adam Stone told me when I was coming up, and he was the guy I looked up to. He's like, to be relevant in this game, you got to have a soft game. And that, yeah, you know, that's still true today as it was back then. Even as fast the game has turned. So at the end of the day, the doubles game is still a very heavily strategy based game, soft game, where you have to be very consistent. And you also, it's more deception based, where you have to create disguise and deception, which it's not just raw speed and power. And that takes time.
I mean, yeah. I'll be honest. I'm surprised. I'm a little surprised that the gap has widened. So possibly could be, you know, a couple years ago, Anna Lee was a soccer player and a pickleball player, Colin's brother, diverse sports background, and maybe just that full on. Now it's real. There's money. It's a job. It's not something to, you know, have some fun with and then move on. So, having and seeing some of these pickleball athletes go all in / off the court, in the gym, doing extra things is definitely a factor, and they can be pickleball specific with it. So, that's definitely one of the things that I see that could be the reason for that. But I'll be perfectly honest, I'm surprised. I've been in the tennis world. So is Rob. These guys and gals are just absolute beasts. And so to see the real struggle for something them coming over, it's just another indicator that the sports will always be connected, but they are very much different sports.
Yeah. I mean, these are the types of conversations that I love. Cause to me, the thing with sports, it's like, it's this fascinating laboratory in a pretty controlled environment for like studying human performance. And so like a question like this, like, why are the top two seemingly expanding their lead when you think it should actually be shrinking as more athletes and more money come in? It's an interesting question. I mean, so I have a theory. I love a good theory. And so I think there's a couple things going on. One is that basically every top athlete in their sport, you've noticed, has like a photographic memory when it comes to their sport. Like you can ask LeBron, like the fourth quarter of some game in 2012, like you ran this action and then like, you know, we had a pick and roll and Bosch was in the corner for three. Like he has this like photographic memory. I remember they asked Steve Kerr because he was doing it in one press conference. Like, Steve, like, how impressed are you with LeBron's memory? And he was like, Steph and Draymond can do the same thing. Like, and you see it with golfers. They'll be like, oh, yeah, this shot in 1997, I had a 155-yard kind of stock 9-iron into the wind. Like, how do you remember that? And, you know, NFL QB is the same thing. They'll be like, oh, yeah, it was like cover two, and then the strong safety dropped down and all this stuff. And, like, this random play. And I think what kind of tipped me off to this was I started hearing players talk about patterns all the times in these interviews. And this made me think of kind of like, are you familiar with this chunking theory in chess? So basically, like, if you show an amateur or someone who's never played chess a chessboard for like a minute, and you arrange all the pieces, and then you clear it, and you're like, hey, try to replace the pieces. How well can you do it? And the answer is not very well. Now you show a grandmaster chessboard, they can look at it for 5 seconds and then clear the pieces and they can replace it. And there's like this awesome video of Magnus Carlsen from a couple of years ago where this guy shows him five random positions of five random games. And immediately he's like, oh, that's game 24 in Seville, 1987, Karpov, Kasparov. Like they showed him one from Harry Potter, a movie. And they showed a chessboard from a movie and he didn't know. And he was like, wait, that's from Harry Potter. And then he goes, and then they went, Knight C3, Queen C6, like he's photographic. So the typical thought is like, well, these guys are like photographic memories, like just in general. But then if you rearrange the chessboard to where it makes no sense, the pieces are nonsensical, the grandmaster can't remember and replicate it any better than the amateur. So what they're really doing is their memory has worked to like chunk things into ways that make sense. So now how I think this is relevant for like pickleball or really like any kind of sport is it's, we think of pickleball, or just say baseball for a second. We think of baseball as like a game of reflexes, right? We think like Albert Pujols is like a great hitter because he has insane reflexes. It's actually not true. There's a story you guys might remember. Do you remember who Jenny Finch is?
Oh, yeah. The softball pitcher.
Yeah. So she was this kind of like hot blonde, like went viral, like softball, like pitcher in like 2004 or something. And she like was dominating the Olympics. And so she's throwing underhand like 65 miles an hour. And the question was like, could she strike out a major league hitter? And the easy answer is like, no, of course not. She's throwing 65 from like whatever, 45 feet. So that's the equivalent of like 95 miles an hour to a major league hitter, which is fast, but it's not a problem for Barry Bonds or A-Rod or Pujols. And so they did it. And these guys were like whiffing and missing by like 10 feet. And so the question is like, why are they missing so much? And the answer I think is because what makes an elite athlete like them elite is not their reflexes. It's actually the way they like interpret and intercept and perceive speeding objects. And they have this like mental database, right? Like this database of like arm angles and like the seams on the ball and all this kinds of stuff. Now the ball's coming underhand to them. They can't see it. And so bringing this back to pickleball, it's like, I think the top players they're building a mental database of like speeding objects and plays and patterns at a compounding rate. Like Anna Lee and her mixed partner make finals of three events every single weekend. So they're basically compounding more reps at the higher level faster than everyone else. And I think, and the only one who's really close is Riley, who makes the finals of two events every weekend. But basically it's like, if you think that like experience and like this like mental database is the foundation of achievement, well, these two are like compounding at a much higher rate. And so I think that's probably the best explanation I can come up with or theory for they're just getting way more tournament level, high level tournament reps at a faster rate. And they're building that sort of mental database. And Tim, that's kind of, yeah, go for it.
Tim, this is why we had you on. This is why we had you on for things like this. Outside of the box thinking. And that's exactly right. I mean, you got to get to 10,000 hours. So, you know, they talk about the 10,000 hours. So I don't care how talented you are. If you jump in the game, you've been playing 3 months, you're not anywhere near that 10,000 hours. So here's another good example is I play whatever I play 2 or 3 years with Dekel Barr playing exclusively the right, even though I played the left at the beginning. So my reflexes are the same. My defense is the same. My counterattack ability is the exact same. And granted, playing with Dekel, I got lit up plenty, but I handled myself just fine over there. Then I have a predetermined partner because Dekel can't play, and I'm playing with CJ at the Hyundai Masters in 2021.
Yeah.
And I'm playing the left side, and I get beyond destroyed. Because it's different patterns. The ball is coming at me from different angles because I've been playing the right side for 3 years. I have used all my mentalness to lock in on counterattack from the left side player to me. And now I'm on the left side getting attacked by balls with no more spin, no more power, no more anything. And I'm getting hit in the chest, in the shoulder, and whatever. Yeah. So it's just a different mental shift.
That's exactly right. You ever see J-Dub if he ends up on the right for like a point because there's some like awkward chaos? He literally looks lost. He looks like a three over there. He looks completely lost. But you guys had on another thing that made me think of this. You had on Leia Jansen, I think, and it was on your podcast. She said she has a vision coach, which is fascinating. I would love to talk to this guy because that's what it's all about. It's about interpreting and perceiving speeding objects at angles. And like, if you're able to somehow improve your kind of like visual acuity, like the way you perceive these things, that could be like the next frontier in kind of like player development. So I think they're super interesting. But like a guy like Tyson, like I watched him play singles and he seems to guess more than anyone else. I don't know if you'd agree with that, but yeah, he does very well, right? He's almost compensating for maybe a lack of length compared to like an Alshon or someone, but his hit rate when guessing is really, really good because he has this mental database built up of high level tournament reps. And in fact, I think maybe removing the back draw will actually exacerbate this problem because the lesser players are going to get fewer and fewer reps. And I think tournament reps and drilling are night and day. And so for 3-0s or 4-0s, drilling is fine because you just need reps of just feeling the ball in your paddle. But I think, I think you made this point, like Colin Johns, when he's playing a rec game, he speeds up every other ball.
Yeah.
But when he's playing a game, he speeds up 1 out of 30. And so like playing a rec game with him isn't really good practice for it. And so you really need high level tournament reps under pressure. And I think there are two players who are just getting way, way more reps on a compounding rate. And I think that's explaining their widening gap.
No, makes a lot of sense. And all you have to do is just this past Wednesday, Travis Rettenmeier and myself played a couple rec games with Federico and Pablo and, you know, going through the motions a little bit. And then I see them on the live stream a couple days later on the PPA tour, slightly different situation, not just with how locked in they are, but their shot selection, their patterns and whatever else. It is very, very different. You need the touches in rec, but nothing compares to high pressure tournament experience. You cannot recreate that.
Yeah.
Which you know, Tim, you mentioned the 3 out of 5, which you're absolutely right. It just means kind of the up and comers are going to get less reps, which, you know, again, lends itself to maybe why the APP could remain in the picture, because you can get those high level, you know, not as high level, but you could still get high level tournament reps, you know, going deep into APPs, where you're not going to get that in PPA necessarily. So, you know, I think it just opens the door more for the APP in terms of going 3 to 5 and no backdrop.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, so, I mean, you get often, I mean, how simple would it be for, you know, a middling team to win 1-0 against a team that's just happy to be their first round, a local team, and then get dismantled by JW and Dylan, and that's their two matches. Like, how much real value did they get there playing those two matches?
And then JW and Dylan are going to have, you know, 8 matches in men's and 6 in mixed and 6 in single. It's like, it's actually, this is kind of a long-winded answer to your question. Like, I'm not as sure anymore that like all these new athletes are going to, I was of the camp that like, oh, like who cares about the top 10 players today? In 2 years, none of them will still be in the top 10. I'm less certain of that. So I think my surprise, if anything, is the game will probably be dominated by the same hand. Now, of course, you can introduce a Jack Sock or someone, but I think there'll be a lot of familiar names in 2 years.
And again, why are we talking about Tennis Light when we could be talking about MLP?
Yeah.
It all comes back to MLP. I mean, what is tournament pickleball anyways?
There's a lot of, it's my favorite there. Three letters. There's a lot of three letters out there. I like the MLP. It's good. I'm going to stick with it.
Not the NPL?
NPL. Oh, don't. Rob, why are you getting yourself in trouble, man? Come on.
I'm a big fan of NPL. I'm a big fan of NPL. I am.
I got stared down and cornered a couple times because of your comments from random people I won't mention. But yes, anyway, I like it. So, hey, fellas. I kind of like this as a stopping point. I think Rob's about to get kicked out of his hotel, and I think
we ran long. But Stone, no, there's one thing I have to insist on. There's a question that you used to ask every guest that you kind of stopped asking.
Oh yeah,
whoops. But it's one of my favorite questions.
What is it?
And do you not know?
No,
Nunnery, do you know?
Who's your favorite Johnson?
Boom.
Oh, that's yeah. It. Okay, so we got Jack, Julie, Georgia, and J Dub. Who's your favorite Johnson, Tim?
Yeah, so like I used to listen to this, and I'd always say I can't wait to come on and answer this question because I have the best story for this. So Perfect. Yeah, it's easy to say Georgia because she's so lovable and high energy and great. J Dub, he's actually kind of funny in his own way. Julie Johnson is, you know, like the matriarch, you know, like kind of always around, super friendly, super nice, like charismatic. But my favorite Johnson is Jack Johnson, and I don't think everyone knows who he is. He doesn't travel to all the tournaments anymore. But so there's a story from MLP Columbus where at the time, this was kind of pre-merger at the PPA, we were talking about doing some sort of franchising and Georgia was on our team. And so I was like, we're probably going to franchise Georgia. Like, I think she can be one of the best females in the world and we'll get her when she's 16 and all this stuff. But I kind of wanted to assess, like, how seriously does she take the game? And so I was talking to Jack and I'm like, you know, Jack, like, you know, we're thinking about franchising Georgia. Like, does she have to get dragged to practice? Does she run to practice? Does she love it? Like, where's her head at? And he's like, Julie's going to kill me for doing the accent, but you have to do the Jack Johnson accent. So he was like, yeah, you know, everyone's always talking about J-Dub, but Georgia, that's my superstar right there, Georgia. And I'm like, what do you mean? Like J-Dub, he's like arguably number one player in the world right now. He's like, let me tell you the difference between Georgia and J-Dub. When they were little kids, we went out to our friend's house, they had a farm, and they get on the ATV. He's going real slow. And she just zooms away. And we're like, I'm like, okay, like, what does this have to do with pickleball? And he's like, this is the same way they play. J-Dub. And I'm like, J-Dub, come on, son. Give it some gas, J-Dub. Rev it up, J-Dub. Give it some gas. I'm like, that is the perfect story for your two kids. And yeah, so
there you go.
That's why Jack became your favorite Johnson.
Jack Johnson, ladies and gentlemen, he finally got picked.
That's perfect. Yeah. And honestly, he's the guy that like makes me smile when I go to tournaments because he's got the best smile. He's just such a happy-go-lucky guy.
Great story, but let's not forget the beginning of that story. My favorite part was J-Dub is kind of sort of funny in his own way. That's a lot of disclaimers. There's a lot of disclaimers.
Kind of sort of in his own way. No, it's true. I feel like that's accurate.
No, it is. It is. Yeah, you get him. He comes out of his shell a little bit. He's pretty entertaining. I'm not going to lie. So, all right, boys, this was good stuff. Really nice analysis. Thanks for coming on, Timbo. Looking forward to dominating this challenger league. That's for sure.
Yes, sir. Roll the dice. Let's go, baby.
Roll those dice. See y'all next time.
Thanks, Tim. Later, guys.
Because you know why?
Why?
Because it feels right.
Legendary. Yeah.